and I spent 6 months at home with my dad. And I think I couldn't really fall apart because he was falling apart. The sleep was really the killer. Like, I had full-on insomnia for 7 or 8 months before I got some help from the doctor. And that was depression, for sure. There's one thing I do now that I didn't do before is vocalize what you're feeling. But it would be the first thing I would do, and it would be the first thing that I would recommend. And it takes a lot of courage to vocalize sometimes what's going on in your brain.
When we launched Naked in mid-2020 with a clear focus on business builders, many came back to us asking, what about us non-entrepreneurs? Well, in this episode, we're talking to Lucy Cooper, who is Head of Innovation Europe at Accenture. She has also been an entrepreneur and an investor, but her life is very much that of an intrapreneur within a large corporate now. Lucy caused a bit of a stir recently when she posted an article where she talked in an amazingly candid way about her mental health struggles, triggered off by a COVID-19 infection in December 2020. We discuss her diagnosis of anxiety disorder and depression after losing her mother at a young age, the debilitating insomnia she experienced at that time, and how this in hindsight should have been recognized as trauma. Lucy shares with us the steps leading to her breakdown last year. Fear plus uncertainty manifesting as anxiety. How do you deal with an overwhelming fear of losing the people you love? Over the years, Lucy has used therapy throughout her life. But after her recent experience, she also recognizes the importance of vocalizing what is going on inside. She's using a multi-strategy approach where anything from meditation, journaling, physical exercise, nutrition, and connecting with nature are important elements. The key in all of this is not to compromise on doing these things that can help. Please meet Lucy.
This is Naked by the Future Farm, where entrepreneurship is stripped to its vulnerable core. Brought to you by Vlady Meškobriestinska and Nektarios Lolios. And remember to subscribe, follow, and rate Naked to help us share it with the world.
Hi, Lucy.
Hello, Nektarios.
How are you?
Hello, welcome. Lucy. Hello, Vladimira. I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
We're good. We have this little tradition when we record Naked that we ask people to tell us where they are. So where in the world are you right now?
I am in Kensington in London right now.
It's a lovely part of the town. I'm in Athens. I'm in Greece. It's supposed to be raining today because every time you mention somebody, I'm in Greece, they go, oh, beautiful weather. It's like, nope. Going to start raining in a moment. And Vlady, where are you?
Still in Pakistan for, I think, the next month or sort. So yeah, far away from both of you. But we're sort of, I was saying this to Nektarios, we were recording yesterday, or one of our extras, we are sort of enjoying, you know, the winter in Pakistan feels like a summer in Europe. So it's actually beautiful from that end. But it's a very different world on so many other levels. But I think that's for a different podcast. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you for joining us, Lucy. For our listeners, it's going to be a slightly different episode because we normally talk entrepreneurs or people who deal with entrepreneurs. But we became aware of you because you posted something on LinkedIn that was quite eye-opening. But also because you are one of those people that work in the large corporations and has a role that is what we could do with inverted commas, call an intrapreneur. So somebody who works in innovation or in change or in digital function, but somebody who has a very different mindset from the traditional mothership and fights from experience, fights battles that are comparable to the ones that maybe an entrepreneur on the outside would face. But on top of that, you're also married to an entrepreneur, which probably also gives us an insight onto your perspective on this. So we thought maybe in our conversation, you can tell us a little bit about your professional life. So what do you do?
Oh.
And then we sort of lead into your LinkedIn post that caused some waves.
Yeah. Absolutely. So very accurate and lovely introduction, Nectarius. Thank you. So I work for Accenture, which, if you don't know, is one of the largest management consultancy firms in the world, $50 billion revenue, 625,000 employees. And my role there is to be the head of innovation for Europe. And so what does that mean? So as you very rightly said, I'm pushing against the status quo of the company every day, which has its pros and its cons. And as we talk about mental health, we can kind of go into those a little bit. But I have the remit really to do a couple of things. One is we have innovation consultants at Accenture who are made up mostly of acquisitions of innovation consultancies or growth consultancies that we've acquired over time, like What If and the D Group are some of our more famous names. We work with them to, with clients to help them grow, essentially. So a similar thing, then if you were an entrepreneur, we help our big corporate clients find their next billion-dollar businesses. And so there's a real area of focus there. And then I spend time looking at our ecosystem partnerships, our technology innovation landscape with our labs and our studios and our R&D centers. And also I spend, you know, a fair amount of my time supporting and advising, I suppose, Accenture on what it needs to do in order to continue to be innovative and try and keep on the front of that curve as we have been for some time. And so that's my job a little bit in a nutshell. I think there are some parts of it that are very entrepreneurial. I'm often the first one to do anything in a certain area at Accenture. It's never been done before. We might not have the legal agreements or the processes or the financial structures to do it. And so that feels very entrepreneurial. But it comes obviously with a level of security and support that entrepreneurs tend not to have. I'm backed by this big corporate. I don't have to worry about making payroll at the end of the month and things like that. So there's a different context to it. I have been an entrepreneur. I have been through Y Combinator and set a company up on the West Coast. I've been a venture capitalist. So I try and take as much of that as I possibly can to my working environment and stay as true to those principles as possible.
I love it when you speak to somebody who comes from that part of the business. It's much easier to get a straight answer. It's very structured. It's very succinct, to the point. We don't need to dig. We have all the information we need right there in one paragraph. Beautiful. Thank you for this. I think it's. I would like us to start straight from the end. I would like us to really kind of jump into. So we met a couple of years ago, and I had no idea that you were going through stuff, because normally when you meet somebody, it's not the first thing you discuss. It's like, hey, my name is Nectarius and I have all sorts of different mental health issues. But when I heard through your husband that you were having a difficult time, especially last year. Yeah. But when you put this on paper and you publish this, the first paragraph in this is like a real punch in the stomach. It's so intense and it's so condensed that it just takes time to digest. And then you beautifully describe the things that you use to get out of this or to find support. We can talk about that, but would you mind telling us a little bit how you experience your own mental health journey? Because you start with losing your mother at the age of 21.
Yeah. So, it's really interesting looking back from, I mean, it's not the end, because I think mental health is a journey, and I think you're forever on a journey with your mental health in the same way that you are with your physical health. You don't become fit and then stop working out. Like, you have to continue to be on that journey and flex those muscles. And I think it's exactly the same is true for mental health. And I think that's why people have ups and downs in like they do in any other part of their life. So, but I sit from a position of, I suppose, relative peace and calm at the moment. So it's very interesting looking back, isn't it? Because I've learned so much in the last 12 months about my mental health that I didn't know before, even though I've had struggles with my mental health before. So I think on reflection, Nectarius, I've always had this part of my sort of personality or brain since I was a little girl. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the things I've been diagnosed with since having been diagnosed with anxiety disorder and how that's opened my eyes to, I think, experiences that I've had from when I was a very, very little girl. But really my first big run-in, I think, with mental health, as you said, was after my mother died. So my mother was sick from my teenage years. She had breast cancer. She was in remission for a small number of years. And then at the end of my first term of university, she was diagnosed with brain cancer. And she, I remember I was very aptly at a drinks bar in Guildford, like one of those terrible drinks bars in Guildford, at back for Christmas, trying to catch up with my friends. And I got a phone call from my brother, who had been at the hospital with my mom, saying she'd been having these fits, like epileptic style fits, but they were localized to one part of her body. So the doctors knew it wasn't like a full body thing. So they gave her a brain scan, and we got a phone call saying she's got two brain tumors under the temples of her brain, and she's probably got 5 weeks to live. And so as the 19-year-old, that's just such an extraordinary sort of experience to go through. And there was a lot of denial, and there was a lot of like, why is this happening to me? I've just started university. I'm young. This is meant to be when I'm having like the time of my life, where there's supposed to be no stress, no hardship, no nothing. She obviously didn't die when I was 19. She was a real fighter, and she went through this, you know, at the time, I think what still is, but at the time was really experimental treatment called gamma knife therapy on her brain, which is basically where they put a very, very targeted laser right into the tumors of your brain by drilling holes in your head and screwing a brace into your head and then onto the hospital table, which is extraordinary. But brain cancer has a very low success rate, because you can't use chemotherapy on the brain because of the brain membrane. So it's, you know, it had some really experimental treatments, but it really was for the whole of my university career. And while everybody else was sort of having fun and being those young late teens, early adults, I was driving 3.5 hours to and from Surrey and Exeter most weekends, as my mother was becoming very, very sick and stayed very, very sick. And she died a few months after I graduated university. And I think she really wanted to see me graduate. And I think she was sort of holding on for that. And actually, I've had two careers at Accenture. I left in the middle, but I had a graduate job waiting for me at Accenture, and they were very good. And they let me push back my start date by 6 months. And I spent 6 months at home with my dad. And I think I couldn't really fall apart, because he was falling apart. And as a young woman, that's like a, you know, you lose one parent and then you feel like you're losing another, is a lot of stress and strain. So I think I went through probably the normal grieving at that time. But as I started Accenture, about 3 months in, I became very, very aware that I was not okay. But I was 22 years old. I wasn't sleeping. I was numbing the pain by going out every night with my friends and using the excuse of being 20, you know, well, I'm 22, like, of course, that's what we should do. But like, really every night drinking, not being able to really focus at work. But the sleep was really the killer. Like, I had full on insomnia for 7 or 8 months before I got some help from the doctor. And that was depression for sure. And so when I encountered the troubles I've encountered over the last sort of 15 or 17 months, which we can go into, I assumed they went into the depression box, even though I was, you know, about to get married and, well, actually met my husband right at the beginning of the pandemic, as you know, Nectarius, and then was about to get married and felt very happy, didn't feel depressed at all. And it took me quite a long time to get to the diagnosis of, actually, you have a pretty serious anxiety disorder. And actually, I think lots of people in society put anxiety and depression together in the same category because they go together in the same sentence. My personal experience have been they're completely different, and they exhibit actually completely different symptoms, and they manifest themselves in your life in a completely different way. And so I now live with my anxiety disorder, and we can talk a little bit about what does that mean and what are some of the tools and how does it manifest itself with me. But yeah, it was really tough. I mean, I don't know whether you want me to go into now what has happened to me over the last year or so and how it sort of triggered, but I'm very happy to do so.
I would, Vladdy, you go.
I think before we would go there, I mean, thank you, first of all, for sharing. It's very important. And we know that, you know, usually it's not easy and we are on the air, but there is already a great amount of value for people who are listening and for us now with Nectarius. And there was this one line that was running through my mind as I was listening, which was that you were very articulate about the experience, and the words you were using were connecting for me to what we were discussing with Nectaris in the past episodes, which is trauma. And the experience that you went through around your mom would, I think, by a textbook, fall into a description of a traumatic experience. And I wonder whether you have, in the diagnosing or diagnosis period, whether the trauma came up. Have you explored it from that angle? Have you discussed it with doctors around? So before you actually got that tick, like, yes, there is anxiety disorder. Is there anything around the trauma that you've been sort of reflecting on or discussing?
So I think it's a really interesting question. So I look back now and I 100% agree with you that, you know, it was a traumatic event. At the time, it was not a word that was used. And at the time when I did go through therapy in my early 20s, early mid 20s, it was not something that was ever really sort of brought up. And I think it's an interesting conversation, and I think I'm not sure how I feel about therapy, trauma, things like that. So yes, it was a traumatic event. I was not treated for trauma. I was treated for depression. So it's difficult for me to look back and say, would it have been significantly different if I had been treated for trauma? Because that was not the experience that I went through. I think now, interestingly, where my anxiety disorders come from off the back of having quite a traumatic experience with COVID, it's a word that is used much more now in my treatment and what I've been through since. And so we can maybe talk about that. And so I think there's an outstanding question for me in society, which is, why is the death of the parent not necessarily considered trauma if it's not perhaps something that's sudden or, you know, something that society looks at and says is an unusual event? You know, someone gets, you know, there's homicide or something like that involved.
100%.
But society would say, well, that's a very traumatic event. Why is watching your parent die of cancer at a teenage age not a traumatic event? Well, it's not seen by society as a, it wasn't seen by the people that I talked to as something that would quote unquote trigger trauma. And it sounds like I'm being critical of therapists. I'm not. I love therapy. I have used it as a lever in whole different, you know, parts of my life, not just for things that have been negative, but for, you know, positive situations where I've wanted to grow. So I'm a big fan, but I think it comes with a health warning of there are good therapists and there are not good therapists, like anywhere else in the world or any other topic. I think you need to, but even there are good therapists who you don't have a good chemistry with. And I think it's hard to expect people when they're feeling really down, whatever that down means, to then have the strength necessarily to go through 6 or 8 therapists until they find the right one.
I have a question that will take us a little bit into your professional life.
Sure.
You had your entrepreneurial experience, you had your investor experience, you had your corporate experience. But all throughout, as you said, you've been kind of having your ups and your downs with your own mental health. It's probably not easy to look back and figure out how you responded to your mental health challenges as an entrepreneur versus somebody who's now in the big corporate. And even within that, with more traditional roles and more, let's call them exotic roles, right? But we're really keen to dig down a little bit deeper into the what happens to somebody who learns to read the signals, and you clearly have a radar for this. You know that something isn't right and you're looking for whatever intervention makes sense for you in that context. So you're on a big trip. You end up in Dubai and you've been diagnosed with COVID. And I have to take a little bit of blame for that because I was the one who suggested to Joan that you should come to Dubai. So you're diagnosed with COVID, and that whole thing brings to the surface and triggers a lot of other things. How does it feel when you're in a different country? There's an element of vulnerability there and you know something isn't right. But you're also, you're an employee, you're working.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, so firstly, I think one thing I will say, and a friend of my husband's, who's a GP, gave sort of said this to me, which when I had come back from Dubai and was sort of recovering. And she said, you don't get mentally ill overnight. So like being in Dubai with COVID was probably the catalyst, but it wasn't the cause, you know? Mm. So I think one thing to say is, like so many people, that, you know, that sort of March 2020 to December 2020 time was pretty extraordinary for the entire world. You know, I think Judson Brewer, who has a book called Unwinding Anxiety and an app, which I'm a huge fan of, which I talk about in my post, sort of in the opening chapter of his book, he has an equation for anxiety and he says it's fear plus uncertainty. And I think that the pandemic was basically a huge scientific experiment of placing fear and uncertainty on every single member of the globe, every person in the world. Of course, like a number of those are going to be so susceptible, they're going to fall into anxiety disorders. There's a reason why we have a mental health crisis off the back of the pandemic, because we lived and are still living, despite what the newspapers might say, through a time when every single day in the newspapers, we were told how many people died. Like, of course, that's going to induce fear into our brains. How many people were infected with this disease we only just met and didn't know how to treat. And then on top of that, you have the uncertainty around, will I still have a job? Is my business going to go bust? Can I see my family at Christmas? You know, will I get it? What will happen to me if I get it? And so I think there's a macro context to this, which was before I arrived in Dubai, which is I had been living through that anxiety, I wouldn't want to say undetective, maybe unwilling to admit for 10 months. And then, yeah, as you say, we arrived in Dubai in January. We made it out of the UK just before the Christmas lockdown, and we went on a trip to Costa Rica where we actually got engaged, and we wanted to not come back to the UK because a lot of our friends had said it's really quite tough in the UK, and maybe if you can work from somewhere else, work somewhere else. And so we landed in Dubai, and within 4 days we'd been diagnosed with COVID, and it was really an unraveling of me. I mean, we were both sick, not very sick, although now I have long COVID. The doctors tell me actually I had what they called acute non-hospitalized COVID, but because we never got a fever and we never got a cough and our blood oxygen levels were okay, I assumed it was sort of fairly mild. Our symptoms that presented were a little differently. I lost a lot of weight, like 8-9 kilos in a couple of weeks. I had the sort of real intestinal symptoms and migraines so bad I couldn't get out of bed, and body aches, but I mean, I can't really explain it, like really, you know, body aches so bad I was sort of crying myself to sleep, but I wasn't sleeping, and that was one of the big issues because I was so overwhelmingly afraid of what was going to happen to us. And not just me, but my husband too. And the questions, as you say, Nectaris, that were running through my brain was, what happens if one of us gets really sick and we need to go to a hospital? And this was at a time when the numbers in Dubai were also quite unsafe for the amount of hospital care that they had. You know, are they going to treat us? Are they going to choose a local Emirati over us? Like, will we get a bed? And the lack of being able to do anything, you couldn't leave, you can't move around, you're entirely dependent on the support of a system that you have no idea how it works, and you're really afraid. And so I was really, really afraid. My firm were extraordinary. They have a 24-hour help, a support and assistance line for employees that are in some sort of stressful situation. And that can be anything from, you know, working somewhere remotely where there's a weather, you know, instance like a hurricane, it can be terrorism, it can be really anything. And they sort of looked after me incredibly well and were an extraordinary support to both of us. And so I feel very grateful for that. But that gratitude came later. I mean, in the moment, I was very, very hyper paranoid of what was going to happen to us. I was testing our blood oxygen levels, you know, every 20 minutes waiting, I think, feeling that uncertainty that something was going to happen, almost like it was a foregone conclusion that this was going to go very badly for the both of us, whilst going through symptoms which were very unpleasant and not sleeping and not being able to lean on or get any support or any care. And it's funny talking about it now because I feel melodramatic. Like I feel like, well, we were fine. We ended up being fine. People continue to die from this horrible disease. And we were lucky. And I do look back and feel so grateful and so lucky. But the toll that it took in the moment on my mental health was something I had never felt before. And it felt completely different to depression, which was for me anyway, was this sort of slow decline where I felt actually very numb. It was very difficult to feel emotion when I was depressed. What I felt in January was the complete opposite. I had too many emotions. I felt too many things. I was completely oversensitized to the world and to every single, you know, trigger that was in the world, whether that was, you know, a text message from a friend, you know, saying I've seen X, Y, and Z on the news about Dubai, are you okay? Whether it was people who were trying to be helpful and calm me down, ended up actually getting me feeling more anxious and more emotional. And so it was almost the polar opposite. And I would say my depression didn't prepare me at all for the feelings that I sort of experienced in January. But it was on the back of what I now recognize was 10 months of burnout, essentially.
It's interesting, Lucy, to sort of listen to you. First time hearing, obviously, the story. And I wonder, have you gone back in your mind or in conversation with somebody to finding a similarity of your experience after losing your mom? And because you, even in our conversation right now, you mentioned some of the similar symptoms, like let's say insomnia, you couldn't sleep. And when you joined your dad, and you said I couldn't fall apart, but you know, there was that state. I wonder, I couldn't help myself to keep drawing a line from that incident, that, you know, the experience that you've had there, and whether you are going back in your mind or not. I don't know. I just want to sort of check again whether you feel that this experience had anything in common, or whether you experienced it from that lens.
I think so. Yes. I mean, I think so. I have had therapy since having COVID and having my breakdown, which I think is what I would call it. Although my amazing and very wonderful therapist said it was a very small, very controlled breakdown / we could call it a crisis instead. So she was using humor there. And then we spent a lot of time obviously talking about, you know, everything that I was feeling and experiencing. And I think we talked about the two situations in that I have, you know, an over-indexed fear of loss. And I think there's a similarity there, right? So I think when you lose, well, I think when you're faced with the situation of losing someone from your teenage years and it's a prolonged experience, and then you do lose them, there definitely, I think, was something built in me that, like, assuming all things I love are going to leave. And so I think that part of the pain that I went through in January was watching my brand new fiance at the time, now husband, be sick and feel that fear of, well, experience has told me that this doesn't end well. And it's not a rational, it's not a rational thing, right? None of this is rational. Mental health is not a rational environment that your brain is operating in. And I think that's another really important thing to say, that my psychiatrist and my therapist kept being very clear about, and it took a real while to get in, which is you can't trust your brain when your brain is feeling this. When you're depressed or anxious or in any other kind of state of trauma or altered mental being, you cannot trust your brain. And so actually what you need to do and some of the tools you need to employ is to circuit break that trust. Because actually people who have anxiety disorders a lot trust that loop. They end up trusting their brain and then they end up trying to compensate for what their brain is telling them. And actually one of the best things you can do is figure out how do you break the circuit and realize your brain is not telling you the truth. I think, yes, we evaluated it in that sense, but actually we went much down into what is it about Lucy's sort of slightly misfiring brain that believes loss is inevitable for her, and how do we sort of circle that square, and then how do we sort of dig into the tools that are needed to build the self-confidence that life is not necessarily going to be that way for Lucy, just because it was like that way for her in the past. So that's kind of, I would say, where we spent the majority of the time. As I said, the word trauma was used much more after the COVID situation, because I think it's an easier, well, for me, it seemed to be like an easier thing for people to pinpoint, as that was like the traumatic event that sort of took you from burnout into crisis, let's call it. But I think that the underlying articulation, which is consistent, is for me, I have this fear of loss, and my brain manifests things in quite different ways, I think, from ordinary human beings in that respect.
But sorry, Vladi.
No, go. I'll ask later.
When I read your post and you talked about your mum, that instantly hit a spot with me, because I lost my parents relatively recently, but in the space of 18 months, and my mum during COVID, and I couldn't go to the funeral. So it was horrible. But so working through this with my therapist, she highlighted that I had this long history of 5 years of experience, multiple instances of grief. So loss followed by grief. And then I needed to work through the recognizing that my COVID experience was grieving, losing everything I had before and not knowing if I would get it back. But the thing that you mentioned, by looking at Jordan or looking at your husband, is my husband pointed out at some point that ever since my mom died, when he leaves the house to go to the gym where he cycles, I started telling him, be safe, which I'd never said before. And I was like, really? And he was, yeah, you always say that. And it's like interesting how you, this kind of comes through in these little things that this now there's this low level fear. We're not going to call it something that impacts my day majorly, but on reflection, it's like, it's there. There's always this bizarre thing that he may not come back, right?
And honestly, Nectaris, I mean, my husband will tell you, every time one of us leaves the house, if he doesn't say he loves me, I like shout, I love you, at him down the stairs or whatever. And he said it really annoys him. And I had to explain to him, like, I'm not going to have you like leave the house potentially in the worst case scenario for the worst last time ever. And the last words we said be like, get some milk or, you know, whatever it might be. But it is a heightened state of anxiety, of sort of awareness. You are waiting for that bad thing to happen. And living in that state over a really long period of time is exhausting. And physically, it does all sorts of weird things to your body. You know, you start getting acid reflux, you get bad stomach, you get, you know, shakes, heart palpitations. It's, you know, bad for your respiratory system, your heart, all of this kind of stuff, because you're constantly pumping out that stress hormone and that cortisol. So it is important to figure out what you can solve for. And that's why mindfulness and meditations become so massively important. And it's become massively important, because I can take myself into parasympathetic nervous system and out of sympathetic, which is the fight or flight nervous system. It's all badness. I think what I have learned, especially over the last 15 months, is acceptance, or I'm still on the journey of acceptance, but it is who I am. It's how I'm made. And there's a lot that you can take away that A, helps yourself, but B, can help other people. It can help other people understand all these different types of personalities from the ones that you have a lived experience with. You can normalize being senior, successful, publicly, you know, sort of publicly available as a person and living with all of these things. And we have seen that so much already, you know, with the likes of, you know, Stephen Fry and all of these wonderful and very famous people who have, you know, different disorders. And I see in the corporate environment that I'm able to continue, hopefully, to fly that flag and increase that normalization and increase that acceptance and make it something that doesn't have to be spoken about in private confidential conversations between you and HR, although that's lovely, but can be talked about openly. Wants to hear it like we're doing today.
I was just about to say that this resonates with us because that's part of the big mission that we are also trying to do is to normalize. So you are contributing through Future Farm and just, you know, through what you're doing in your daily life and how you talk about it, how you live it. And I actually wanted to explore this bit a little bit. So what we do talk a lot with the entrepreneurs when they come on the show is actually that life path that they sort of chosen for themselves, which is to be an entrepreneur, and it has a specific trait. And with you, Lucy, what is really interesting is that, as we defined it at the beginning, is the intrapreneur, and that you have a lot of entrepreneurial type of experiences, even within, you know, large organizations such as Accenture. What's interesting for me is to understand a little bit more with the awareness you have about who you are today. Can you also tell us a little bit more about what are some of the, if there are there actually any stressors in your daily life linked to your professional life, to the past, to the work that you do daily, that potentially might trigger some of your, you know, buttons when it comes to the mental health? So tell us a little bit more, because we are quite aware what this means or what this is now for entrepreneurs. And we are in our third series and we've been hearing a lot about that. We haven't had anybody from with the similar experience that you have as an entrepreneur. So what are some of those stressors?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I live in a highly stressful environment, right? I would say I have a huge amount of stresses on me every single day. So, of course, there's things like just the workload, which, I mean, entrepreneurs have as well. But like when you work for a company that's got 624,000 employees and, you know, services like 90% of the Fortune 500 as its clients, that just comes with a workload that's very stressful. But, you know, I think the stresses are slightly different. So the stresses that you come across in a corporate environment when you're senior are, there's a lot of leadership responsibilities that just come with part of the job, right? There's a lot of town halls. There's a lot of, you know, leadership meetings that you have to go to, that you have to be present to, that you have to prepare for. That is the kind of internal structure and construct of how these big corporates work. So there's a kind of stressor on that level. There's also a stressor in terms of the work I do tends to be with the C-suite of some of our biggest and most important clients, right? You can't mess up going and talking to a Fortune 500 CEO. You know, you have to be unbelievably prepared. And then you add on that the fact that you're telling them probably to do something they've never done before for the first time and to put their trust in you, and you put your trust in each other, and you're going to try and figure out this partnership. That's, of course, incredibly stressful because I'm creating. I'm not really taking something that my firm has been doing for the last 30 years and optimizing for it and, you know, delivering something where there's a roadmap and a playbook and a process that we know works. I'm the pioneer. I'm the first person doing things with clients for the first time. And in that respect, I think it's very similar to entrepreneurship. You know, it is, you've got to have the faith, you've got to have the self-confidence, you've got to have the courage and the sort of, you know, slight audacity, I say that in a good way, to kind of go out there and give it a go. And then, you know, the budgets that we're dealing with, you know, are not the hundreds of thousands, they're often the hundreds of millions. And there's a material impact of something being potentially right or not for both us and for our clients. And so I think that's also a stressor. And then the last one is people. So of course, entrepreneurs have teams. My team is probably 10 times bigger than the average entrepreneurial team. And I have to think, and it's one of the things that kind of I love that gets me up in the morning, is I'm always trying to optimize, you know, for other people's success. I'm always trying to look out for the opportunities of that would be a really great opportunity for X person to go and do. And in that respect, working for a consultancy is really cool because it's much, you don't have roles, so to speak. There's a lot more flexibility. There's project flexibility. You can sort of change and edit your leadership team as required as you update your strategy. I feel very grateful in that respect that we don't, you know, consultancies are not a kind of fixed role, you know, sort of point of view. Even my role is not a, you know, I will do it for a few years, someone else will do it, you know. So I think in that regard, it's good, but it means the management of people, of trying to figure out what is the right role for this person right now, what is right for their career, how do I help that person be successful? When you're talking about a large group of people where you can't have one-to-ones, you know, how are we going to reward and remunerate? Concepts like inclusion and diversity and equity, unbelievably important for us at Accenture, but also for me and my team as the innovation team. That's stressful. And you feel, well, I feel anyway, if it goes wrong, I feel like it's my personal responsibility. I feel like that is a reflection on me as a leader. And, you know, sometimes that's you know, can be incredibly stressful. So that's kind of the stresses. And, you know, it's sort of every single day. You know, that's not something that happens once a week. You know, that I encounter that list of things I just told you sort of every day. That's what makes up my day.
No, that's very helpful. Thank you.
I find it interesting listening to you. And there's very much, and having been around for a while, it made me smile to some extent, as a client perspective, which, of course, in the business you're in, you have a very strong client view. I'm curious about the stresses of being the innovation person within the company. So how does it feel if you are fighting for attention or C-suite time within your organization and you're the innovation person? Are you still the slightly more out there, outlier, woo-woo, misfit, versus somebody who leads the financial services practice? Or, you know what I mean? The people, or maybe if we can flip it on its head, and I'm going to be slightly kind of polemic here. Is it more acceptable for the head of innovation to be public about their mental health struggles than the head of the financial services business?
Wow. I'd love to say no, but I think possibly. I mean, we can go ask Paul, who's the head of financial services, see what he thinks. But I think, again, there are pros and cons with being the innovator, right? One of the pros is I'm not expected to look and sound like everybody else. I actually have a lot more permission, which is a word we haven't used yet, to bring my whole self to work, I would say. But it's not a permission that's given to me by Accenture. I think Accenture gives everybody that permission. I think it's probably more a permission that's given to me by clients, teams, external people looking in. You know, like a really ridiculous and, you know, shallow example is how I dress. Like, I go to meetings at banks quite often where my colleagues are in suits and I, you know, I might be in a shirt and a blazer with jeans, but I'm not wearing a suit. And, you know, the conversation a lot is like, well, of course we don't expect Lucy to turn up in a suit, you know? And so there's this permission around, I suppose, the boldness of my personality, which I naturally have a bold personality anyway. Of course, some innovators are, you know, introverts and they exhibit their entrepreneurship in a different way, but or their innovation in a different way. So yes, I think Nectarius, there is a permission that is given to me that comes with a sort of an inbuilt disruption permission, right? That actually it comes with an expectation of disruption. I think that there are cons to it as well. I think I'm also young. I mean, I'm a woman, as you can hear. You won't be able to see us, but I'm also young. And that's a bit of a triumvirate of, you know, potential bias against me. There's an age bias that people can exhibit to me that goes on top of the innovation bias. Oh, so she's coming to talk to us about innovation. Two, how much can she know? She's like, look at her. She can't be that old. Three, you know, I hope not anymore, but, you know, she's a woman, like potentially plays into it.
You know, in some way, I know that you just said that it's probably different from the entrepreneurial journey, but actually it reminded me the relationship with investors. Like once you have the investors, some people say you become an employee and you have people on your board and you can be fired. And so, you know, there you have stakeholders to manage. So that was just a sort of a reflection. I am cautious of the time, and I would really sort of, it would be a shame not to go into this last bucket, which is that you're very articulate about the experience that you went through, and your level of awareness, it's very visible. You were also very articulate in your blog post about sort of this multiple strategy approach to sort of nurturing your well-being. So which of those that you listed, and we'll share with you guys the link to the blog so you can read up on it, but which of those are, Lucy, your favorites that go to when, let's say, even now on an everyday, you know, job, everyday life, something hits, where do you go? Where do you tap?
Yeah, so I'm a massive fan of the multi-strategy approach because you don't maybe always feel like jumping on the Peloton and doing a 45-minute ride. But before I talk about that, I would like just to say there's one thing I do now that I didn't do before. And if I can compel anyone listening to this who is struggling, is vocalize what you're feeling. And that would be always, I don't know if it's a coping strategy, but it would be the first thing I would do. And it would be the first thing that I would recommend is, you know, we talked earlier about your brain is lying to you, and it takes a lot of courage to vocalize sometimes what's going on in your brain, especially if you're having particularly unpleasant, unwanted, or intrusive thoughts that come with that anxiety. I can't tell you what it feels like to vocalize it to someone that you trust and hopefully love and have them tell you one of two things. Two, I hear you. It's okay. You're not on your own. And more often than not, I've had these feelings that you're talking about as well. I've had these thoughts. And actually, you can then go and find in a whole bunch of communities, including through like Judson Brewer's app and things like that, where he tells you what you're thinking. And he tells you millions of people feel what you're thinking. And it helps to normalize, yes, but to really provide immediate relief. And I can't encourage that enough. To me, it's like, you know, pulling the plug out of an overflowing bath. It's not going to empty the bath, but it starts to give that anxiety a place to go. So my first thing I would do is try and vocalize to someone, anyone, even if it's an anonymous phone line, those people are trained in this stuff, is please tell someone how you're feeling, because it is cathartic. And it really genuinely could, you know, save a life. In terms of after that, what's my favorite coping strategies? Well, one of the biggest differences that I made is I don't compromise my mind, my meditation every morning. So I used to do it when I could. And if it came to meditation versus exercise versus, you know, getting on a cool half an hour early, the meditation would fall off because I thought exercise was more important than meditation. And now it's not an either or for me, it's an and. And if I have to make a choice, I'd rather do 20 minutes of meditation over a 30-minute Peloton class. So I'd say, you know, my number one tool that's made a really big difference, and Sam Harris's app Waking Up, which my husband sent me over a WhatsApp on after our second date, where I said I could never get into meditation. So I really do have him to thank for me finding Sam Harris, who I'm also a little bit in love with. Sam Harris's app I can massively recommend. You can do a 30-day free kind of trial. So I would say, you know, sort of meditation. As I said, I journaled again, like I journaled for like, if you're in a particularly bad place now, journaling really helps. And in particular, I tracked my mood and I tracked my anxiety. So I would draw horizontally across a page, 30 days dates, and I would do 1 to 10 on the axes. And I would literally plot and draw a curve of how I was feeling. And against every single day, I had to have wins for the day. And when I was in a particularly bad place, that made a massive difference, because when you're feeling overwhelmed, you feel like you felt overwhelmed for the last 100 years. And having something to go back on and say, actually, on Tuesday, I gave myself a 2 out of 10 in terms of anxiety. And now I'm giving myself an 8 out of 10. But on Tuesday, I was a 2 out of 10. So for 2 days from now, I also could be a 2 out of 10 again. You know, those kind of things really help you. And then looking back at the wins, looking back at the things that you've done is massively helpful at breaking that cycle of your brain lying to you. So I think that would kind of be another kind of thing I would recommend. I think if you can get into nature, you know, there's lots of proven things now about like literally going and walking in trees is amazing. And in Japan, they have all these gardens. Now, I spent 6 weeks when I wasn't working with my dad, who lives in the countryside, and we would go walking in the forest every single day. And exercise, sure, but like, it doesn't have to be killing yourself on a running machine or a Peloton or whatever is your particular choice of pain and suffering. You know, long walks, you know, I started after I was, you know, took time off of work walking. Like, I did a lot of walking and a lot of listening to podcasts. And so those are some of my favorite things. And then I just, before we leave, want to give a huge shout out to nutrition. I started seeing a nutritionist. They changed my life completely. 90% of the serotonin in your body comes from your gut. You cannot have a happy head if you have an unhappy gut. And so starting to figure out, like, so, you know, legumes, fish, or it doesn't have to be fish if you don't eat fish, anything with omega oils in it, nuts and all of that kind of stuff. Broccoli actually has more protein in it per gram than protein powder. All of that kind of stuff is amazing. Quit drinking, you know, focus on your gut, focus on those probiotics. And that will, I think, really start to give you the baseline that you need to find the strength that you need to go on that journey. And it's a marathon, not a sprint. And you can still eat the cake and drink the glass of wine. But, you know, it's about being aware what you need and when. And I still have bad weeks, you know, where I have a week of client dinners and I eat bad and I drink too much wine and I don't do any Peloton. And that's okay. And you shouldn't beat yourself up for that. But you then have to be as committed to then the next week, be kind to yourself.
Very and give whining. Yourself super nutritious. This whole thing. No, but on a real sense, very vulnerable and very nutritious. Yeah, very enriching.
Thank you for having me.
I have a feeling we could have easily another episode where we just talk about permissions, because we didn't even go there. So when you were talking about the permissions, it's also giving yourself permission to do certain things, right? It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I'm really grateful. Thank you so much, Lucy, for joining us. Thank you for sharing your story, your insights. It's also nice to talk to somebody who can assume the other perspective and kind of observe what was happening. But also, it's also interesting to hear how you kind of compare your experience against that of your husband's, because there's parallels, there's differences, and it's nice to have that context. So thank you very much for joining us at Naked.
No problems at all. It was really fantastic to talk to you today. And I think it's very gracious what you're doing, helping helping everybody by listening to more stories is step number one.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you. Take care.
Join us next week to reflect and digest.
You've been listening to Naked by the Future Farm, where entrepreneurship is stripped to its vulnerable core. To learn more about our work, sign up to our newsletter or visit thefuturefarm.co. where you can also apply to be a Naked guest. Naked is produced by Dan Turgel and edited by Catherine Dworkin. And remember, subscribe, follow, and rate Naked to help share it with the world.